No, I'm just... what we're going to start doing tonight is we're just going to start going over some different scriptures that are used to suggest that a person can lose their salvation. We're going to just try to understand what these scriptures are actually saying. That's our goal. So we're... This is... I don't have a sheet for these. These are... We're just going off my notes, and we're just going to be looking at these verses. And we're going to start tonight in Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy 29, and we're going to put in at verse 18. We're going to look at verses 18 through 20. Keep in mind, the verses I'm using are verses that have come off of lists of people that have listed these as verses that demonstrate that a person can lose their salvation. These aren't some that I've guessed at. These are ones they're actually trying to use. So, Deuteronomy 29, verse 18, it says, Let's go back to verse 17 to pick up. It says, "Moreover, you have seen their abominations and their idols of wood, stone, silver, and gold, which they had with them. Unless there shall be among you a man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord, our God, to go and serve the gods of those nations, lest there shall be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. And it shall be when he hears the words of this curse, then that he will... boast," or literally what he's... They're translating this boast, but it's a word in the Hebrew meaning to bless. It's the barak, to bless. And so in other words, he's blessing himself, saying, "I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness or the imagination of my heart, in order to destroy the watered land with the dry." Verse 20, "And the Lord will never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him, and the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven." What people that hold to the teaching that you can lose your salvation, what they suggest off of these verses is that if a person turns from God, God will never be willing to forgive them. In other words, that's it. You turn from God, there's not another chance. It's done. It's over. What we want to see is, and of course, what they're doing is they're taking this of salvation. Spiritual salvation. So loss of salvation is the way they're handling this passage. So what we want to do is we want to look and try to determine, is this what is actually being said? And to go back to verse 1, remember, most of the time, if there's a question about what a scripture means, then what's your biggest helper most of the time when it comes to...
Believer or unbeliever.
Well, yeah. But if you're a believer, it's context. Context, context, context. Look at the context and see, does the verse indeed say what it appears to say? Usually, once you read a verse and it's... I've come across verses that somebody suggested, I scratch my head and I'm like, what is that? And then you go back and you read the context and it makes perfect sense in the context. But all by itself, standing alone, don't get it. So if you go back to verse 1, it says, "These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab." Remember, Moab is on the other side of the Jordan River, just to the southeast of Israel. Besides, or literally in addition to, the covenant which he made with them at Horeb. Horeb is Sinai. So this is now a second covenant, and it's very clear. It says this is a covenant he's making with them at Moab, and it is in addition to the covenant he made at Sinai. It's not simply a repetition of the same covenant. And he says in verse 2, "And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, 'You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land. The great trials which your eyes have seen, those great signs and wonders.'" Now consider this. He's talking to a generation of adults. The oldest people among this group would be 60. Because remember, everybody from 20 on up died in the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. So the only people that were left were the people that were under the age of 20.
Well, and Joshua
and Caleb.
Maybe closer to
Well, they'd be, yeah, they'd be quite a bit older than Joshua. What is Caleb? Caleb is 80 years old when they do the conquest of the land. He says, God promised me this mountain. And he goes and leads a battle charge at 80 years old up the mountain. But remember, at that time, people were still living extremely long lives. Moses lives to be 120, and there was no reason Moses would have died at 120 had he not disobeyed God. So he probably would have gone on and lived. So don't think of these people in terms of our age capacity today. These people are still closer to the time of Noah and the things that were before the flood. But we had people 20 years and younger that did observe what happened. They were teenagers. Some of them were kids old enough that they remembered real well. Oh, I remember the things that happened when we were down there in Egypt. I remember what God did. I remember going through the Red Sea. I remember, you know, maybe some of them are saying, I remember holding mom's hand or dad's hand as we walked down through the Red Sea. I remember that. I remember that big wall of fire that kept the Egyptian army at bay all night. And some of those things are really probably vivid in their mind, even though it's 40 years ago, which, if you're like me, there's things that happened to me 40 years ago. Well, 40 years ago, I was graduating from... No. 40 years ago, I was 8. 9. I was 9. I was 9. I remember a lot of stuff that happened when I was 9. I can remember a lot of events and different things that transpired at that time. So, these people remember this. And so now he's asking them to consider what God has done for them. Verse 5. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out. Your sandal has not worn out on your foot. You have not eaten bread, nor have drunk wine or strong drink, in order that you might know that I am the Lord your God. When you reach this place, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, came out to meet us for battle, but we defeated them. And remember, Og, king of Bashan, how big was his bed? 13 feet. It's telling you this was a really big man. These were giants. Og would have been bigger than Goliath. Goliath was somewhere between 9, maybe close to 11, depending on what cubit you use. Og was closer to 13. So these were huge people. And they come out and God's reviewing all this. And so with that then, he goes and he asks them, if we go back to verse 14, now, not with you alone, that is with just you people standing here, am I making the covenant and this oath, but with those who stand here with us today in the presence of the Lord our God, and with those who are not with us here today. For you know how we lived in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. And they saw all the idols of all these other nations. Everywhere they went, everybody else was an idolater. And that is what he is talking about here then in this context, is he is contrasting the false gods in verse 17 of these people to God himself being the true God. And what he's doing is he's warning them then in verse 19, it shall be when he hears the words of this curse that he's going to bless himself. He's going to go, oh, no. I will have peace. Now, one of the things that might be helpful in understanding peace, the Hebrew word for peace, shalom, meant completeness. It meant everything was as it should be. So, in other words, one way that you might have peace is you have good health. That's completeness. Another way that you might have peace is you got plenty of food in the barn. That gives you peace. You might have peace in the fact that all your property and everything's intact and you don't have to worry about raiders coming and stealing your flocks or coming and raiding your crops. And all of those things meant everything was complete. It was whole. It was as it was. And the result was you had peace. So this person's blessing themselves. And what they're saying is, I have peace even though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. In other words, I can go and serve other gods. I can do what God's forbidden us to do. But everything's fine with me. And he says in that case, verse 20, the Lord shall never be willing to forgive him. Which is what God had described previous. This is not a person losing salvation. This is an Israelite who is foolishly saying, I can go and serve other gods and everything will be just fine. And when God says here in the context that he would never forgive them, what he's saying is, in the middle of verse 20, that every curse which is written in this book will rest on him, and the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. To blot out his name from under heaven doesn't mean, again, to lose his salvation. It means he's going to die. It means that he is erased from the people of Israel. He's come under the curse, and the curse will eventually cause, will bring about his, shall we say, his premature death. So in reality, this verse has nothing specifically to do with whether a person loses salvation or not. It has to do with whether a person lives or not. Now, one of the questions we could entertain is it possible for a believer to go off and serve other idols? Well, I don't know why a believer might not. It doesn't make sense, but we have sin natures. Our sin nature, one of the works of the flesh is idolatry, and Paul twice tells us, once in Colossians and once in Philippians, that covetousness, craving more, is idolatry. And Paul has plenty of warnings about believers coveting, indicating believers covet, which means believers are idolaters. And in 1 John, John has to tell the believers over there at the end of the book, 1 John 5, the last verse, he says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. And telling you that there were believers that sometimes engaged in idolatry. Probably the kind that we understand more often in terms of bowing down to an actual idol that is carved, but also sometimes bowing down to stuff, coveting stuff, as Paul said. So both of those, and believers do those. So if a believer today could engage in that kind of idolatry, I don't know why we would have to say believers in the Old Testament couldn't do it. But God has not, this is important for us, God has not issued a curse upon you as a believer today if you're foolish enough to engage in idolatry. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to enjoy the best God has to offer you in your Christian life while you're doing that, because you're obviously out of the will of God, which means you're not going to be enjoying all those things that God has planned. But
isn't this a promise in regard to the land and the Palestinian covenant, which was based upon obedience?
Yeah, well, see, he says in verse 19, and it shall be when he hears the words of this curse that he will, verse 20 is the one I wanted. The Lord will never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will burn against him, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him. And the thing is, we didn't look at him tonight, but those curses are right back in chapter 28. He gave blessings and cursings. Blessings if you did the right things, that you'd have good health, and your livestock and your crops would do well, and curses, that you wouldn't have good health, that your crops and your livestock wouldn't do well. And you know what? Today, where we are, last year they had early frost in Michigan. Severely hurt apple crops and cherry crops. Now, had you lived a couple of hundred years ago, that would have been devastating. I'm sure it still was devastating for the farmers that were out there. But, you know what? If their crop goes bad, they can still go to the store and they can buy food that maybe was made somewhere else in the world. We don't feel the impact of this, that if your crop goes belly up because you've come under the curse, what it's like for you to suffer because you don't get to eat anymore. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you might eat more meagerly because you have your budget stretched to the max and you can't buy what you used to eat. So you may grow thinner. So I'm not saying it can't ever happen to us. It could easily happen to us. Our food supply could be completely messed up and disrupted and things like that. But it's not something we commonly relate to. Other parts of the world do. They relate to this tremendously, that they're still doing this, have this problem. One other thing that I want to address out of here, and that's at the end of verse 20. It says that the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. I want to look at a couple of other passages that use some similar language. And if you look back in Exodus 32, now it's not identical language, but it is similar. And similarity is not identity, but we're going to, I think, at least draw a comparison to help us understand what's happening. In Exodus chapter 32, in Exodus 32, we have the people worshiping the golden calf. And God's response to them worshiping the golden calf in verse 9 of Exodus 32, and the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. And to a very limited, narrow view, that could have still fulfilled some promises to Abraham. But it wouldn't have filled the blessings that Jacob declared when he actually had all 12 of his sons walk by or come to him as he was leaning on his staff, and he went and blessed all 12 of those sons with future blessings. And that promise that he made to Jacob, even though it wasn't a covenant, was as real of a promise through Jacob as the promises or covenants that he made to Abraham. And therefore, we would say God really couldn't have done this. This is a test for Moses. In verse 11, and then Moses entreated the Lord, his God, and said, O Lord my God, your anger burnt against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand. Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil he brought them out to kill them in the mountains, destroyed them on the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to this people. And then he says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Notice he doesn't call him Jacob, he calls him Israel. Your servants to whom you did swear by yourself and did say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So, verse 14, so the Lord changed his mind. It's one of those verses that we've looked at previously about the harm which he said he would do to the people. The harm was not to take these people and cast them all into lake fire. It was to kill them. Okay? Because probably many of these people among there were probably believers. There may have been some unsaved people among these people. But it, whether it's saved or unsaved, that was not the issue at all. But if you go on down in the context, down to verse 31, then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book which you have written. And the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of the book. But go now and lead this people. Now God says, I blot out those who sin against me. Moses says, I want you to blot me out. Now what's Moses asking for here? Is he saying, I want to go to hell? No, this is not what Moses is asking for. Moses is saying, if you aren't going to honor your promise to the people, kill me. I don't want to live if you're not going to honor their promise. Blot me out of the book. And Moses understood this, that God has a book, which we're going to take a look at in just a second here, a book that describes those who live upon the earth. And what God says in verse 33 is, I blot out those that sin against me, which is exactly what he did under the law. He doesn't do this particularly today. God can chasten people to the point of death today. But there are a lot of people, a lot of believers that sin, and God doesn't chasten them. And he doesn't chasten them to the point of death particularly. But under the law, God made some rules. And when they sinned against many of those rules under the law, remember, out of the Ten Commandments, nine of them had a death penalty. If you stole, wasn't a death penalty, but if you stole a person, kidnapped, death penalty. If you perjured yourself or bore false witness, didn't get a death penalty, unless your false witness would have involved the other person dying as a result, then you paid with your life. So nine of the commandments you died for. And the last one, thou shalt not covet, you didn't enforce it by putting people to death, but the word that God uses, God switches the word covet from Exodus 20 over in Deuteronomy 5 when he repeats the law, the Ten Commandments over in Deuteronomy 5. He uses a different word for covet, and that's a word which he, in the book of Numbers, says the people committed and God personally killed them for doing that. So in reality, God could kill a person for any of the Ten Commandments. as well as many of the other commandments. Because remember, according to the rabbis who took the time to count them all up, there's supposedly 560-some commandments in all of the law, total. Okay. So this is what God's saying. I blot out of the book those that sin against me. Now turn over to Psalm 69 in connection with this.
Wasn't Israel lax on enforcing, so they didn't really follow through with what they were supposed to do?
No.
They got judged for that.
And that created a problem. And I as a human father, I can see why they did that. Because if I had neither of my daughters were particularly rebellious. Yes, they had moments of a rebellion. I think every child has moments of rebellion. But I didn't have a stubborn, rebellious child. But can you imagine if you did have a stubborn, rebellious child? Do you think you could go to your neighbors and say, my son is stubborn and rebellious? And bring the neighbors out and they bear witness to what it is. And then they all help you pick up rocks and then you stone him. Outside. Really what it did was it made mom and dad the enforcer of a death penalty on their own kids for being rebellious. And leading that charge.
Which would motivate them to raise them up properly.
It would. Yeah. But the thing is if you didn't, which they didn't do, in fact, you could go to the book of Judges. How does the book of Judges start? One of the first statements in the book of Judges.
People did what was right in their own eyes.
Okay, there's that. But the other one is, the other statement is, and there was another generation that came along that did not know Joshua and the fathers. They didn't know what God had done. So sorry, what happened? All of a sudden, a generation comes along, you got all these people, and they don't know that. They don't know the stuff that God's had. Apparently, their families didn't do what God told them to do. They didn't rehearse, say, kids, it's time to sit down. Let me tell you when I was a little kid, we went through the Red Sea. You know? Come on, get the grandkids over here. Seriously, I'm not trying to make fun of, just imagine thinking about that. This should have been Grandpa's job. At 80 and 90 and 100, Grandpa should have been saying, I want to tell you what happened. You pay attention to this God. He's not to be trifled with. But they didn't do that. And you got a generation that came along, and they did what was right in their own eyes, because you got a generation that did not learn who God was.
And
because the parents...
take care of his boys at the temple, God said, you love those boys more than you love me.
There you go.
And held them responsible.
Yeah. And the thing is I watch parents do the same thing today. I watch parents with bratty kids that, nope, not my kid, nope. It's like, take the blinders off. Look at what your kid did, face up to it, and take care of it. But he didn't want to do it, so it's... What happened back then still goes on today. Okay, doesn't mean it happens with everybody. But yeah, they didn't enforce it. Because they didn't enforce it, Israel ended up just having no end of problems. In fact, one of the things that they weren't supposed to suffer a witch, they put up with those. They weren't supposed to put up with people that led them off into idolatry. They were supposed to put them to death. They didn't do that. And so, you know, it's just all along the way. They didn't enforce these rules, and they tolerated these people doing this. And eventually, the whole nation ended up going astray. Now, Psalm 69. Let's look at this verse here in Psalm 69. And verse 28, it says, and may they be blotted out of the book of life, that's the way the American Standard reads. This is Psalm 69:28, and may they not be recorded then with the righteous. Now, because it's translated in many of your Bibles, the book of life, people are looking, well, don't you have people in the book of life at the great white throne? Their names aren't in the book of life, so they look at these people's names in the book of life, and they're written out. In fact, I actually heard a pastor one time tell me that in history, God wrote every name of everybody that's ever going to live in the book of life. And when those people reject God, he erases and he blots them out of the book. And this is the verse that one of the verses that guy used to try to teach that. But what is being talked about, if you go back to verse 1 of chapter 69, This is a Psalm of David. You can see at the heading, it says, "Save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in deep mire, and there's no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail while I wait for God." Now, if you just stop there, you're going, "What did he fall in the river?" But see, this is all poetic language for what he says in the next statement, verse 4. "Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. Those who would destroy me are powerful, being wrongfully my enemies. What I did not steal, I then have to restore." And he goes through there talking about the way these people have treated him. An important aside in this is that this psalm, there are parts of this psalm that are quoted with regard to Jesus Christ. If you look in verse 9, it says, "For the zeal of your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." Both of those statements are used about Jesus Christ. What is the first one? "The zeal for your house has consumed me." What's that?
Drove out the money changers.
When Jesus drove out the money changers out of the house. Okay. And those people were pursuing their own aims. Jesus drove them out. And as a result, what they were doing was they were insulting God, but since it's kind of hard to insult God, they really insulted the God-man, the one that was right there, which is what the reproach meant. Reproach was a real, hostile, vicious insult. And then it goes down in verse 20, it says, "Reproach has broken my heart. I am so sick, and I looked for sympathy, but there was none, for comforters, but I found none. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. And may their table before them become a snare, and when they are at peace may it become a trap." Those are used with regard to how Israel treated Jesus Christ on the cross. And Paul quotes verse 22 in Romans 11, that Israel's ultimate rejection came when they set a table for the king that consisted of vinegar and gall. So really what is being recorded here is man's hostility towards, first of all, David, but then past David to the God-man, to the person of Jesus Christ, and how they were hostile. And remember the hostility. Remember the words that they called out for him. "Crucify him. Crucify him. Away with this one." That was their response. And it's these type of people then that he says, if you go back in Psalm 69, verse 26, "For they have persecuted him whom you yourself have smitten, and they tell of the pain of those whom you have wounded. Do you add iniquity to their iniquity?" And "may they not come into your righteousness, that is, and they may not enjoy the blessings that you have promised them for us. May they be blotted out of the book of," and this is where the Hebrew text is better rendered, "living," not the book of life. This isn't the book of salvation. This is the same book that Moses was talking about over in the book of Exodus. The same thing that he's referring to in Exodus, in Deuteronomy 29. It's the book of those who are alive. And he says, blot them out of that book. In other words, kill them. Kill those rebels. Kill those horrible people that have persecuted and treated me horribly. And may they not be recorded with the righteous. Don't write their names down among the people that are doing righteousness, being the people that get to live. Is the point.
Or don't let them live among the righteous.
Right. Yes. So, all of this then, to go back and just make the simple observation that Deuteronomy 29 is not talking about God refusing to forgive a person and allow them eternal salvation in the end. It's about the fact that God will not forgive those who would turn aside from God to serve idols. He wouldn't forgive them. They would come under the full penalty of the law. He would bring the full cursings that he had promised in Deuteronomy 28 down on them, and they would be blotted out. They're going to die. Simple. So it says nothing whatsoever to do with, if we look, in other words, to me, if I were reading this, If I didn't have an agenda in mind, I would read Deuteronomy 29, and I would never see in that a statement about salvation. I would think solely that this is talking about discipline, God's discipline on the nation of Israel. Okay. There's one more short one that I want to look at then this evening. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 15.
Is the Book of Life and Revelation, is that, do they capitalize that in the NASB, like the proper, is it like a unique, the Book of Life? Because this to me, you know, this is like small book, small b, small l.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if the NASB tried to make a distinction between...
They don't. They have Book of Life and everything's small over there, the Book of Life, yeah. So they're, I guess they decided to let you make the judgment call. They weren't going to make it for you. Okay, 2 Chronicles chapter 15. 2 Chronicles chapter 15, and it's the first two verses of this chapter, and it says, 2 Chronicles 15, verse 1, "And the Spirit of God came on Azariah, the son of Oded. He went out to meet Asa and said to him, 'Listen to me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you when you are with him. And if you seek him, then he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, then he will forsake you.'" Now, you can see how a person, if you just read that verse, and you didn't look at anything else here in the context, you could see why a person might take that verse and say, ah, see, God will save you. He'll be with you. But if you don't, if you forsake him, God's going to let you go to hell. He's going to abandon you. He's going to forsake you. If you don't pay attention to context, which is what we're going to do. We're going to go back, but we're going to read just a little bit more of this. But I do want you to go back to... let's see, I think I had this written down. Oh, no, we're going to read ahead. We're going to keep reading. It says, "And for many days, Israel was without the true God and without the teaching priest and without the law. And in their distress, they turned to the Lord God of Israel, and they sought him, and he let them find him. And in those times, there was no peace to him who went out or to him who came in, for there were," notice this was the situation, "many disturbances afflicted all the inhabitants of the land. The nation was crushed by nation, city by city, for God troubled them with every kind of distress. But you be strong and do not lose courage, for there is a reward for your work." Now, this is still the statement that's being given here as he's going out here to speak to Asa. This is Azariah, remember, from verse 1, one of God's prophets, and he is speaking to Asa here, the king, and he's saying, you know what, if you people would seek God, God would be with you. What he meant by God would be with you is God would be protecting you. It goes right back again to Deuteronomy 28. He'd bless you. Armies would come up against you one way, they'll flee seven different directions. But what he records happened in verses 4 through 7, prior to this time, was they hadn't. God had allowed them to be found by them, but they hadn't really done this. And as a result, these people were in just a mess of distress. So it was to the contrary. The curse of Deuteronomy 28 was, you'll go out against a nation, and you will flee seven different ways. In other words, the tables are turned. And that is exactly what had happened to them. And so, when he tells them back in verse 2 that the Lord would forsake him, he's not saying abandon him to go to hell. He's saying the Lord would not stand with him when he goes to battle. When you guys fight, when these enemies come out, the Lord's not going to stand there and protect you and take care of you. Again, nothing about spiritual salvation. It's about physical deliverance. It's about God watching out for Israel. And I think what we're going to continue to find, not through all of our texts, but through some of the texts that are named, that this is what people are doing. They read these and they confuse the nature of salvation. They may confuse present tense salvation and discipline with eternal salvation. They may, in these cases, confuse physical salvation and deliverance from physical death, and confuse that with then eternal salvation again. They make the two the same. And so what we're trying to show you is now this is just a question for you, and I know you're probably going to say no, but did we come here and take these texts and in any way twist them and try to change what they're saying from what the plain, ordinary sense in the context meant? No. Well, this is what happens sometimes. And I'm not saying that everybody does this, but a lot of people, when they come to these things, they so want to find something to prove what they believe that they search for any statement and they look at it and they don't examine the context. I think sometimes it's blissful to be ignorant of the fact that the verse you're using to say such and such doesn't actually mean what you think it says.
So there's a preconceived notion that they're trying to back them up.
So many people don't see the difference of Israel and the church.
Well, that too.
And it's market.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think we saw that when we were looking.
They think a believer is a believer is a believer, and they are. It's all believers in God, but they have a different relationship.
Yeah, the object of faith, the content of salvation, all these things are very different. God's promises to Israel are different than the promises he's made to us.
Now, this is a little bit off topic, but an unbeliever, say in the Old Testament, so they went to Hades, right? Unbelievers today, they go to Hades too, so they're all mixed together. There's no separation out there.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, there's no
there may be in some way a distinction God makes, but I'm not aware of it. So, yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay.